All right, guys, are we ready for today? So today, we now move into the PG-13 part of the series. We are talking about this topic right here, the truth about sexuality. Now, we'll do this in two parts. Today, we'll discuss the truth, and next week, we'll cover the lies about sexuality. It'll really be like 2 weeks, but one big sermon between the 2 weeks. I will tell you that the church that I grew up in, I would have never heard a talk like I'm about to give you this morning, okay? And so we're all adults in here, right? I mean, not really, but we're heading that direction. So we can handle this. So even though today is about some truth, we still need to discuss some lies the church believed about sexuality in the early days. When you look at the people in the church, like the old church fathers, as they called them, they had some pretty messed up views on sexuality in the church. And so we're going to cover some of those kinds of lies. I recognize that the lies I'm going to cover right now at the intro of this talk are not lies that you probably fall victim to or fall prey to. We'll cover those next week, the ones that you might fall victim to. But we've got to understand, like, the context of because the church throughout history had a complicated relationship with the topic of sexuality. And it was very complicated. So here's a few old people for you to know about and what they thought. I'll be very brief on this. This guy's name was Clement of Alexandria. And he is someone that said sex was not for pleasure, but only for reproduction. And that's why he looks so sad in that picture right there. And then you have these two, Tertullian and Ambrose. And both of these men, I guess they agreed on this topic, but they both preferred extinction of the human race rather than for people to engage sexually. That's what they believed. And then there's Origen. Maybe you've heard of him. He thought sex was evil. He taught the Book of Song of Solomon wasn't really about a husband and wife, but he taught it as an allegory of God and Israel. If you've read that book ever, it's strange to think about that. This person is Gregory of Nyssa, and he taught that Adam and Eve were created without sexual desire, and if the fall, like the first sin, had not occurred, the human race would have reproduced in some other way. Just a strange belief system. And this guy looks very intimidating. This is Jerome. Looks like he's in the mafia or something. Maybe killed a few people, I would think. This guy was kind of crazy. If he experienced any kind of sexual desire, he would throw himself into briar bushes, creating pain to distract himself. He would also beat his chest with a rock. He looks like someone who would do that. And then Augustine, maybe you've heard of Augustine. Before becoming a Christian, he sinned sexually in his pre-converted state. But after he was saved, he said, it's not that sex is wrong in marriage, but the passion associated with it was sinful. So he even counseled married couples to not have sex. Now, this last one, I saved the most awkward one for last. And this is a guy named St. Francis. And apparently he would take snow and he would make the shape of a woman in the snow, maybe like a snow woman, and he would just kind of cuddle with them whenever he would, you know, be tempted. And so to quiet his sexual desire, this is what he would do, a true story. And I have to ask the question, listen, I have to ask the question, how did this become public knowledge? Because either he told someone he did this, or someone saw him, both of which are very strange. Another question I have is how did he become a saint? He became a saint somehow after this. I don't know. I don't get it. Maybe they've changed the rules for sainthood since then. I don't know about that. Something else very interesting. Listen, Something else very interesting is during the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church had some really messed up views on sexuality. So during the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church started telling married couples when they could and could not have sex. Now, they forbid it on Thursdays because that was the day on which Jesus was arrested. Now, every Thursday we're talking about. And they forbid it on Fridays, which was the day of his death, and on Saturdays to honor the Virgin Mary, and even on Sundays to honor the dead saints. So, if you're doing the math, I'm sure a lot of people called in sick Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And this raises all kinds of questions for me, because how did they enforce these rules? This sounds pretty ridiculous. It sounds like they were created by a bitter pope who was sworn to singleness, is what my opinion is on that, how that came about. So criticizing the church throughout history is somewhat deserved, but there's another side to this equation. So whenever you hear the words sexual revolution, you might think of the 60s and 70s in our world today, when the world began throwing off the old repressive system that the church had imposed. And everyone during that time began to embrace a new, they called it healthier expression of sexuality. And now 50 years later, it's still seen as like this, the sexual revolution in the 60s and 70s was a time when the culture said to the church, you know what, forget, we don't care what you think about sexuality. We're going to do this our way. And they still see it today as like they're free and that we're somehow not free with what we think about it. There's another side to the story that never gets told, though. And I'll describe for you how sexuality was viewed in the Roman Empire before Christianity came about. So this is how a couple of ideas that were prevalent in the empire. The first was there was a double standard for men and women. So women were expected to never have sex before marriage, and once they were married, only with their husband. But men in the empire were permitted to do whatever they wanted. There was a total double standard in the Roman Empire. The next idea is that sexual morality was determined by the powerful. So every culture has a sexual morality, and that morality is grounded in what they believe sex is for, its purpose. Well, in Rome, they believed that it was for just personal pleasure and for the enjoyment of people with high social status. That's how they viewed it. And so Christianity began to change this, bringing about the first sexual revolution. And so sex acts were judged in light of God's created order. And so if marriage gives us a picture of Christ's relationship with the church, then even the sex act tells us something of that relationship. So for Christians, the rightness or wrongness of a sexual act was no longer determined by the double standard between men and women, or by the powerful, but it was determined by covenant love. So there's a blog on Gospel Coalition I read a while back that said this: Christianity reimagined sex as no longer a mere appetite that we could barely control, but as a joyous, even sacred expression that reflects the way God is saving the world. So there were immediate results in the Roman Empire because Christianity guarded the vulnerable from exploitation. So men no longer had the right to abuse people sexually. That changed. Christians changed that. This was the first sexual revolution. Most don't think about that Christians caused the first sexual revolution. Of course, we say that in the 60s and 70s, that happened later again, but in a different way, with the world rejecting some of the thoughts of Christianity. But let's talk about today, because in late 2017, it's hard to believe this is almost 10 years ago now. In late 2017, there were accusations in Hollywood about a movie producer named Harvey Weinstein. And women were accusing this man of a lot of predatory behavior. And he was a movie producer. So on October 15th of that year, an actress named Alyssa Milano, she tweeted the following: "If you've been sexually harassed or assaulted, write, quote, Me Too as a reply to this tweet." And this hashtag, Me Too, went viral. And by the end of the day, that phrase had been used over 200,000 times. Now, a movement took off, and stories of harassment and abuse spread through politics and media, religious circles, and it continues even today. But where did our culture get the idea that people in power don't have a right to abuse or exploit people? Well, they got it from Christianity, and they don't even realize it. There are some people today who wish we could return to like the good old days of Rome, where people could just be sexual with whoever, whenever, and however they wanted. But they forget what came with that. What came with that was a lot of abuse, exploitation, men oppressing women. And so we cannot have that both ways. So our culture sends these mixed messages about sexuality. They will say that sex is no big deal as long as it's between two consenting adults. But the minute that someone is abused or exploited, suddenly sex is a big deal. Recently, I read an interview of two Hollywood figures who had to film an intimate scene while making a PG-13 movie. And in the interview, the woman said that she got drunk beforehand to dull her discomfort. Now, why does the interviewer ask her about their comfort level when filming this scene, but not the other scenes? Well, it's because everyone knows that there's something important, vulnerable, and powerful happening when two people are intimate in this way. So we don't get to pick and choose when sex is a big deal. It's always a big deal. And we'll spend today looking at why. So turn your Bibles to Romans chapter 1. Because in Romans 1, Paul writes about how all people can know something about God by simply looking at creation. So look at Romans chapter 1, verse 20. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. Now, this verse is not a statement about sexuality, but I want you to see the bigger point, because it says that God's eternal power and his divine nature are clearly seen in what he has made. So the visible always reveals something about the invisible. So all of creation, what we see and experience, reveals something about God's nature and who God is. If you were to go look at an art museum and you look at certain artistic paintings or sculptures, you could see something about the personality of the artist in their art. And the same is true for God. Like, we see something about God when he creates. Anything that's been created tells us something about who God is. So everything created tells us something about the Creator. And this is true even of sexuality. Even sex tells us something about God. What does it say about him? Well, it tells us that he's good, that he gives us good gifts. And you see, the world has so distorted sexuality, there are some Christians who find this difficult to believe. We have said throughout the series that marriage is this picture of Christ's relationship to the church. And so if marriage points beyond itself, then it would only make sense that sex does as well, that it points beyond itself. But here's what I think we do. Instead of allowing creation to point us to the Creator, we allow the creation to replace the Creator. We commit idolatry. So next week we're going to look at some ways that we do that, like how sexuality gets broken, how you and I fall for lies around this topic so often. But today we're looking at its purpose. So what is the purpose of sex? Well, Genesis 1:28, we start there. And it says, "And God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish and of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth.'" So Genesis says that God makes mankind in his image, and he wants his image to fill the earth. This is why he commands Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply. And this is his first commandment to them. No one ever complains about this command, do they? We don't complain about this command. So the first purpose is procreation. the first and most obvious purpose. We still have to say it, though, right? We still have to bring a highlight the obvious, but we still need to talk about it. So the first question that many of your parents had to answer was, where do babies come from? That's the first question that your parents had to answer for you. And in an ideal world, your parents have this conversation with you, unless, like in my story, there's the loudmouth kid in like second grade who tells everyone, and you're like, what? And your parents find out that you already know, and they're like, now we got to have the conversation a little bit earlier than we thought. So parents hopefully follow up and explain more fully, but usually kids begin asking those questions around like age 4 or 5. They get curious about what, like, how does this happen? And this is difficult, I think, for some Christians to grasp, but this was God's plan. The way that some Christians think of sexuality, it's like they believe that God made male and female on the sixth day, but on the seventh day while he's resting, that like Adam and Eve thought of the idea. That's how some Christians tend to think about it. Like, no, God designed this. We forget that sometimes. The second reason, purpose, is restoration. Now, all throughout the Old Testament, we see God commanding the Israelites to perform what are called covenant renewal ceremonies, to remind them of their covenant with God, and to remind them like who they are as a people and who God is as their God. And God would have them do these covenant renewal ceremonies to rekindle their heart for God. The person that you are married to is your covenant partner. But what can happen over time as you get older and stuff is you start to forget that about your relationship with them. And so God designed sex to remind you of the covenant, that you're one with this person. He designed it to rekindle their heart toward the other. So sex within marriage, it acts as like this covenant renewal ceremony. And God designed it to renew and restore the covenant between husband and wife. It's God's way for two people to say, I belong completely to you. And so sex creates oneness between the married couple. Genesis chapter 2 says this. Then the man said, this at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. This is the moment of creation. And Adam is basically writing a poem about what's happened with Eve. And then in the next verse it says, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. So God gives sex as a gift to restore, to renew the covenant, to create oneness. And if sex creates oneness, then it does so even when it's done sinfully. So whenever someone engages sexually, you enter a deeper unity that's not only spiritual and emotional, but also neurochemical. So there's a chemical called oxytocin that is released in the brain when someone starts to head down the physical road in a relationship, and this generates bonding between two people. This brain chemical is released in both male and female, but more so in women. It also happens for a woman whenever she gives birth and whenever she is feeding her baby. And this bonding brain chemical is a gift from God, and it helps a couple build trust, which is essential for their relationship. And this reaction, this chemical reaction, happens even in the early stages of anything happening in a physical relationship. So I already told you this earlier in the series, but I'll say it again. I think it bears repeating that in high school and even like a little bit in college, like where I kind of crossed some physical lines, some physical boundaries in some of those relationships, I told you how it made the breakup a lot more difficult. Because getting out of that relationship, those relationships, it was like coming off of a drug. And that's described here. Like there are chemical things that happen in your brain when you start to head down that road with someone. And the relationships where I did not cross any of those lines, yes, it was difficult when the relationship ended, but it wasn't the same kind of breakup. We had a lot of respect for each other. There was a mutual trust and respect that we had for one another. And it wasn't the same kind of awkward situation that the previous situations had created. The next purpose is sanctification. This is a fancy word for spiritual growth. And you might ask, well, how does sex grow someone spiritually? Because we generally see that as keeping us from growth. Here's how it does. In a marriage, if there is anger and bitterness and resentment, it affects the sexual relationship. So sex reveals problems in the marriage that would never be dealt with if sex did not exist. So this is a Tim Keller quote from his book on the meaning of marriage. He says this, "The Bible gives us a high view of sex. It is a sign and seal of our oneness with each other and with God. We should not then be surprised to discover that you may find problems showing up in bed, which if it wasn't for sex, you might never have seen." So because sex exists as part of the relationship in a marriage, you can't just sweep problems under the rug, because sex forces you to deal with problems in the relationship. And if you don't, you're not going to have a healthy marriage. So let's answer another question that flows, I think, from this first question, which is, what is the purpose of sex? Well, why is sex reserved for marriage? I want you to think in your mind right now that if one of your Christian friends or one of your unbelieving friends came to you and said, "Yeah, I know that you Christians believe that sex should be saved for marriage, but why?" If they ask you the question, why, what would you say to them? Do you even know why that's the case, except for the fact that your parents tell you that or we tell you that? How would you answer that question? So we're going to answer that question for you right now. Sex is the only thing which before marriage God says no, but within marriage God says yes. I can understand your confusion, because it's the only thing I can think of where before marriage God says absolutely not, but once you're married God says, yeah, sure, because nothing else is like that. Like, murder's not like that, right? Nothing else changes like when you get married except for that, as far as I can tell. And I know it seems to you that God is holding out on you, like that God wants to kill all your fun. It's not true. Because if God designed sex to renew and restore the covenant made between husband and wife, then sex can't reinforce the covenant if there is no covenant. So that's the answer for you right there. If someone asks you, why is it reserved for marriage? It was designed to create oneness and to reinforce the covenant, and it can't have that function if there is no covenant. It's being used for a whole other purpose, a purpose it was not intended to be used for. And it might seem like all the people that are, you know, having sex outside of marriage are the ones who have it so good, and all these poor, oppressed Christians, people saving sex for marriage, it can seem like they're the ones missing out, but that's not true. The opposite is true. Those who have separated sex from covenant, they're the ones missing out. They're the ones experiencing it in a way that it was not intended to be experienced. Keller goes on to say in his book, "The Bible does not counsel sexual abstinence before marriage because it has such a low view of sex, but because it has such a lofty one." So you have to get out of your minds this idea that God is holding out on you. He's not holding out on you. He's trying to protect you. He wants to guard you. I read this really helpful analogy in a book by a guy named Sam Alberry, who wrote on this topic, and he said, imagine that you walk into a bank and you see two different people at the desk, and they're both making a transaction at the bank. And from the outside, both situations look the exact same. So both are making a cash withdrawal. And they each have a big duffel bag. And the person behind the counter is putting big stacks of bills into the bag. Now, one person in the scenario is simply a wealthy man who's making a large withdrawal at the bank. He's putting it in a duffel bag, which, yes, can scheme can seem kind of sketchy, but that's what he's doing with the money, I guess. And the other person that's there is doing the exact same thing, but this person walked in and told the bank teller, I have a gun in my coat. I need you to give me $10,000 and put it in this duffel bag. So from the outside perspective, both people are doing the same thing, but one is doing it legally, the other is doing it illegally. The person doing it illegally is taking what is not rightfully theirs. And this is what is happening when someone gets involved sexually outside of marriage. Because from an outsider's perspective, it can seem like, oh, they're just showing each other how much they love each other. No, no, no. If they're married, that's true. If they're not married, that is not true. They are taking something that is not rightfully theirs. That person is taking what's not rightfully theirs. They don't belong to you. You're not in a covenant relationship. So it can't reinforce the covenant if there is no covenant relationship. So whenever we do anything sexual outside of marriage, we are saying to that person, I only want part of you. I don't want all of you. And God says, don't become one with someone physically unless you're willing to become one with them in every way, emotionally, spiritually, legally, in a covenant relationship. C.S. Lewis, he once used this picture, this analogy. He said, sex without marriage is like tasting food without swallowing and digesting. So after this service, you guys will probably go have lunch somewhere. And imagine if while you're eating a sandwich, you're chewing up your food, and instead of swallowing your food, you decide to just spit it in a cup. That would be disgusting, first of all. But secondly, you wouldn't get the full effect of eating. It would just be like a tease. Like I just tasted the food, but I never got to really ingest the food and use the food for its purpose like it was intended. And C.S. Lewis says, this is what it's like when someone engages sexually outside of marriage. Because it's not fulfilling, because it can't reinforce the covenant. It's going to fall short of its intended purpose. So those that are having sex outside of marriage, those are the ones that are missing out. In 2001, which is a long time ago, there was a movie called Vanilla Sky, and Tom Cruise is one of the characters in that film. And his character has this one-night stand with a woman who's played by Cameron Diaz. And later in the film, she challenges him on this, and she says, don't you know that when you sleep with someone, your body makes a promise whether you do or not? In other words, you and I, we can't separate physical from spiritual. So to engage sexually without acknowledging this deeper union, I think is a form of deception. And we'll talk about some of those deceptions next week. One last quote. Keller says, sex is God's appointed way for two people to say to one another, I belong completely, permanently, and exclusively to you. We must not use sex to say anything else. Okay, you guys are going to head to your breakouts. Freshman girls over here, sophomore girls over here.